From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Governor Snyder's new budget proposal means no more private companies feeding prison inmates.
In Snyder ease, I think he said something like, this is an area where we haven't had success, which that's Governor Snyder's way of saying this failed.
Community health centers watch and worry as Congress and the White House try to agree on a budget and restore their funding.
The community's on pins and needles, the staff's on pins and needles, and, you know, we get these reassurances, but until we actually see that things are passed to the president for signature and he signs, there's tons of anxiety.
Repaying student loans, what we could learn from other countries.
We would not see any defaults. We would not see any loan collectors because basically the loans would be from the government and the payments would be to the government.
Those stories and more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Governor Snyder today presented his eighth and his final budget to the legislature. Zach Gorchow of Gongra News Service is here with us now from Lansing. Zach, what jumped out at you most in the governor's budget?
Well, I think you'd have to say the governor's announcement that he no longer believes the state should have prison food service run by a private company. That service should once again be run by state employees. It's been roughly 5 years since the state outsourced prison food service from state employees to private contractors. It's been really one bad headline after another on various fronts. The contract was set to expire this summer, and the governor took the opportunity with the budget presentation today to say, we're going to need some funding in the budget to pay for state employees to do this again.
So basically, he's admitting that experiment was a failure.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't use those words, but, you know, in Snyder ease, I think he said something like, this is an area where we haven't had success, which that's Governor Snyder's way of saying this failed. It did not work out.
Okay, so ending Michigan's use of private companies to feed prisoners. What else?
Well, I think clearly the K-12 schools increase is certainly newsworthy. This is the largest increase that schools will have seen in the per pupil foundation grant in some time. That's the basic way that the state funds operations of K-12 public schools. The lowest funded schools will see $240 more per pupil. The highest funded ones will see $120 more per pupil. This is a little bit better than the sub-inflationary increases to the per pupil grant that have been occurring for many, many years. And for schools out there that are really feeling the budget pinch, it will provide a little bit more breathing room. Not a ton, but a little bit more breathing room than they've had.
Is he also looking at the roads? Because that's certainly on everybody's mind, especially with the way they are this winter.
To an extent, the road funding plan that was enacted in 2015 called for the state to spend $1.2 billion more on roads than it was by the 2020-2021 fiscal year. And as part of that, the state was going to, for the first time, make consistent contributions to roads from its main checkbook, the general fund. And that was basically going to phase in the amounts phasing in from $150 million for the upcoming fiscal year, rising to $600 million by FY21. So what the governor is saying is he wants to speed that up. So instead of $150 million for the upcoming fiscal year, he wants that to be $325 million. So you're talking about $175 million more than previously would have been expected, which is not nothing, but when it comes to the cost of road repairs and whatnot, it's still kind of a drop in the bucket. You know, nobody should suddenly expect that all these pothole-scarred roads and whatnot are magically going to get better overnight as a result of this, but it is more than was expected.
There's also money for poor people accused of crimes. Tell us about that.
Yeah, there's still waiting some details on this, but broadly, the state a couple of years ago really took some dramatic steps to deal with what most people would say was a broken system for assuring poor criminal defendants who couldn't afford their own attorney had adequate, competent legal representation. You know, if you read your Miranda rights and you're told if you cannot afford an attorney, one will be appointed for you by the court. Well, in practice, some of those attorneys weren't doing a very good job. So local governments, through a commission that was created through this new law, have been putting forth proposed plans on how to improve their indigent defense systems. And there are a series of guidelines that a panel called the Indigent Defense Commission is imposing. And these are guidelines that will cost money. This could be things like assuring criminal defendants have a private meeting room they can meet in with an attorney. Obviously, if a criminal defendant is meeting with their attorney and law enforcement is within earshot, that's probably not the kind of system you want, but it costs money to build those kinds of things and to assure adequate pay for the attorneys doing the work. So the governor is proposing $46 million in new spending to help implement this. Exactly how it will be spent and on what remains to be seen, but that's broadly what that's about.
Zach, let's talk about some politics here. We have certainly seen state lawmakers get feisty with the governor. They handed him his first override of his veto. That was last month. First time they did that to Rick Snyder. So how do you think this budget is going to be received by the legislature?
I mean, I think there's going to be a little bit of heartburn in some places because, of course, the governor is not on board with some of the tax cuts that the legislature is pursuing. And, you know, if the legislature wants to go ahead and cut taxes, unless there's a big uptick in revenues, you know, some of the things the governor's proposed doing, like $175 million more for roads than was expected, perhaps the scope of the K-12 increase, the additional funding to universities, some of those things are going to be a lot harder to do. There's not a lot of new revenue in the state right now to pay for new programs. So if they do decide to cut taxes, I mean, it's very simple. They'll simply need to not do some of the new investments the governor's proposing, and they may need to reduce spending a little bit to afford them. It's not that you can't do it. It's just a question of what the priorities are.
The governor says this budget is a major change from his first one in 2011. You have covered the Snyder administration for its entirety. So how have you seen the governor's thinking and budget priorities shift during his tenure?
Well, I think there's some constants. He's always been about paying as you go and not getting looped into long-term commitments and debt and that kind of stuff. That's one constant. Clearly, the economy of the state is on a much sounder footing than it was when he first took office. So, you know, his first budget had, you know, massive spending reductions. And, you know, the last several years have all been incremental spending increases by and large. So there's a lot more stability. But I do think, you know, today with what we've seen on the prison food service contract, you know, clearly there is a recognition there that while, you know, on the bottom line basis, the state was able to save a little bit of money from what it was spending on state employees, that hasn't worked out, that the service just hasn't been as good. There have been too many problems. And while the governor, you know, is a certified public accountant and, you know, has been a very much a spreadsheet, data-driven governor, this shows he's decided, you know, there is more than just the dollar figure here to decide success.
Zach Gorchow from Gongwer News Service. As always, Zach, thank you so very much.
Oh, thanks, Cindy.
It's Wednesday. Time to talk about Michigan's history.
I, Gerald R. Ford, do grant.
The other passengers there reluctantly gave up their seats, but I refused.
The young man makes up his mind to work. There's no limit to what he can do.
This is truly the next chapter in General Motors' recovery and turnaround.
You're living at a time of extremism, a time of revolution.
The opening ceremony for the Winter Olympics happens Friday in Pyeongchang, and right out of the gate, the snowboarding competition starts on Saturday. There's a sort of debate now about who actually originated snowboarding. Was it a man named Robert Trumbull, a newspaper editor who was born in Chicago and who worked in Honolulu? It is said in 1938 he combined surfing and skiing while he was on vacation in Yosemite National Park. Or was it the West Michigan dad who came up with a way to get his little girls outside and playing on Christmas Day, 1965? That dad is Sherman Poppin. You decide. Here's my conversation with Sherm Poppin from January 2014. So, Sherm, what were you trying to do that Christmas Day in 1965 in your garage?
We lived on the shore of Lake Michigan in Muskegon, and they had about, well over a foot of snow on Christmas Eve. So we got up Christmas Day, and after the toys were used, My wife decided that we ought to get outside and play because it was a little hectic. I took these two small skis and put them side by side and put a brace across them to hold them together and something to put your foot against. And we literally started sliding down a hill, standing up.
Tell us how your wife came up with the name for this new toy.
The kids were having so much fun, and I suddenly realized we were really surfing the snow. She put the contraction of the word snow and surf together and came up with the word snurfer.
And, Sherm, how long did it take for the name to morph into snowboard?
Well, now this is 14 years after I did it, and you have to realize patents are only good for 17 years. What happened was Jake Bergen Carpenter, the carpenter of the Burton boards, he came to one of the contests in Western Michigan in 79. He saw what was going on, and he got pretty excited with his own stuff, and he went back to Vermont and started making snurf boards. And so I wrote him, say, the word snurf and any derivative thereof belongs to Sherman Poppin. And if you want to keep making these things, you're going to have to pay him a royalty. That was probably one of the dumbest things I ever did because he stopped making snurf boards and started making snowboards.
You know, I got to wonder, Sherm, when you watch snowboarders like Shaun White just blow the crowd away, that was one of the big memories of the last Olympics. Can you believe it, from Muskegon to Sochi?
No, I really can't. And I can remember the very first time it was in the Olympics, I really just couldn't get away from the set watching them. I just couldn't believe that it all started in my little workshop.
That is Sherm Poppin. I spoke with Sherm in January 2014, just before the Sochi Olympics, as he talked about his invention, the Snurfer. And coming up, simplifying the way we repay student loans. We'll look at what lessons Congress could draw from Australia and England. Plus, three seniors from Belleville High School talk about overcoming the obstacles that young women of color face today. That's in 10 minutes here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Student loans. They're the key for many to getting a college degree. But repaying those loans can become the proverbial albatross around the neck of millions of Americans. Consider this. Americans owe around $1.3 trillion in student loans. Nearly 5 million people are in default, and millions more are behind on their payments. Susan Dynarski is a professor of public policy, education, and economics at the University of Michigan, and she's an expert on financial aid for higher education. She recently testified in Washington before the U.S. Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions. Susan Dynarski, welcome to Stateside.
I'm so pleased to be here.
What was the crux of your message to the senators?
The senators asked me to come and talk to them about how other countries deal with their student loan programs. The vast majority of students don't borrow that much for college. You know, $1.3 trillion sounds like a lot, but that's in part because we have a lot of people going to college, which is good. The typical student coming out of a place like the University of Michigan is borrowing about $30,000 in order to fund their BA. And people who drop out of college borrow more like $5,000 or so. Interestingly, it's the people who borrow that $5,000 who are most likely to default.
I read your testimony. That jumped out at me. Why is that?
Basically, the people who borrow just a bit, go to school just a bit, they go in not earning very much money. They tend to be non-traditional students. They're more likely to be going to community college. They're more likely to be going to a for-profit college. And we don't have much of a safety net in our country. If you come out of school and you got a little bit of debt and you got low earnings, things can go badly quite quickly.
And the kinds of life consequences people face from defaulting on student loans, that you can feel that your whole life, can't you?
Indeed. I mean, even with the small amount of borrowing, once the fees start to hit, if you fall behind, a small debt can snowball into a large debt. far too quickly, I think. The regulations around this are too loose, I would say. But if you default, that affects your credit rating pretty much immediately, which can affect, of course, the cost of borrowing for a car, the cost of borrowing for a home. There are employers who check credit records and will not interview or hire people who have a blot on their record. There are landlords who do the same. And of course, there's the daily calls and harassment from student loan collectors. So all in all, it's not a pleasant experience, and I don't think it's one anyone's seeking out lightly.
And in this country, no matter how small the paycheck, the bills keep coming, don't they?
That's right. In the U.S., unlike in many other countries, the typical approach to student loan payment is that in the first 10 years after you leave school, you pay a fixed amount for your loan. This is called a mortgage-style payment in the sense that it's the same all the time. It's amortized over a certain number of years. And I and many others have argued that this is completely out of whack. The first years after college are when earnings are lowest and most volatile. We saw in the last recession, and we see consistently, in fact, that young workers are the ones that bear the brunt of any sort of economic shocks. They often are loosely attached to the labor force. Their hours get cut. They have intermittent and uncertain earnings, and this is the worst time possible for them to be paying back their loans.
What are other countries doing that's better than we are? How are they doing it?
So in Australia, students borrow about what they do in the U.S. for their university degrees. In England, they borrow far more. They borrow probably three times as much as they do in the U.S. In both countries, repayment flexes with people's earnings. So think of how we pay our payroll taxes. You know, we pay our Social Security contributions and our Medicaid. We pay that as a percentage of our paychecks. If we don't get paid in a given week, we don't pay our payroll taxes. And that is how student loans work in these countries. If you have your hours cut or if you lose your job, then you're not making any payments because you don't have a paycheck or you have a smaller paycheck. And it's that automatic elimination of the payment, which I think is critical to helping out the most economically insecure.
What about that time frame? And you talked about here in this country, you got that 10-year period. Do they have a more flexible time period?
The U.S. has the shortest repayment period that I've come across in any country. So 20 years, 30 years. In Australia, there's no limit. It's basically, you know, if things go poorly, then you don't repay. And at some point, if you start making a good salary, then you do start to repay. Typically, people pay off within about 8 years in Australia because you can actually pay off faster with a good income-based repayment program because the people who do well then pay more. So people who get a law degree, for example, might be paying off in as few as 3 or 5 years. You know, the problem with our repayment system is that we're punishing people who are doing poorly and we're not actually letting people or automatically having people who do well pay more.
Susan, I've got to wonder, who is really benefiting from student loans? And here's a case in point. I know somebody whose $20,000 in loans became $30,000 over the 6 years it took him to get his PhD. That becomes a new principal balance, and it winds up being $60,000 paid back after 10 more years. So which means somebody out there is making $40,000 in interest profit off of this one brand new PhD. And you multiply that by people going to college and grad school all over this country. Who's making all that money?
Well, it used to be that the banks did because our loan program was set up in such a way that that extra profit would go to the private sector. Since about 10 years ago, the federal government runs all of the student loans. And so any profit there might be actually gets plowed back into other student aid. Whether there is a profit depends on what the other interest rates are in the country. So certainly not all of the interest that gets paid back is profit. The government has to pay for funds. You know, the government sells bonds and we buy them at a certain interest rate. So that's the cost of borrowing for the government. But to the extent that there is a profit, it tends to go into paying for other people who default or for paying for something like, say, Pell Grants.
Do other countries have governments lending to students?
Indeed. In fact, it's the norm across the world. It used to be that not many people went to college, and so the approach for funding for those few who did was free tuition and maybe even a scholarship and a stipend. So across Europe, that was the model. And then we had an explosion in college attendance. And rather than continue that model, most countries have introduced some form of student loans, paired with a subsidized tuition, but some sort of borrowing. So what's typical across the world is some sort of borrowing. What's not at all typical across the world is the disastrous level of default and financial distress that we see in the U.S. And that's why I think it's important to look to other countries for solutions.
So in this examination of our system for repaying student loans in this country, what are the politics in all of this? I mean, I'm wondering how open you felt the senators were to your message of how other countries have a more flexible, simpler way of letting people repay their student loans.
They seem quite interested in and open to the ideas. I mean, the best demonstration that something works is to see it working someplace. So that's why I wanted to bring in the international perspective. You know, it would be a new system to get off the ground, and I understand the concerns about the bureaucratic complications. We do have a good model, however. You know, we have payroll taxes, so we figured out a way for employers to figure out and calculate how much people should pay on an annual basis in their payroll taxes. So we're not starting from scratch. One complication on the Hill is that the committees that deal with something like payroll taxes and the committee that deals with student loans are different committees. And these they share jurisdiction. They would probably need to talk to each other and cooperate. And cooperation is not a thing that's in supply on Capitol Hill right now.
That is probably an understatement. If you could make it happen, you could wave some kind of a magic wand based on what you know is working in other countries. Take us ahead a few years after changes you believe could be made are in effect. What would the student loan repayment system look like in this country?
Well, people who have very low incomes would not be paying anything at all for their student loans. That's the approach in England and in Australia. So in Australia, if you're making less than, actually it's about $50,000 a year, you're not paying anything. Once you get above that, you start paying a percentage. 4% of your salary starts automatically coming out of your paycheck and heading off to your student loans. So we'd see people with low earnings not paying anything. Perhaps when they hit their 30s, they've been out of college for 10, 15 years, and they hit their stride, they might start paying at that point. We would not see any defaults. We would not see any loan collectors because basically the loans would be from the government and the payments would be to the government. Private banks, Navient, Sallie Mae, that now do servicing of student loans, they'd pretty much be out of a job at that point because there would be no longer any role for them. So there is political opposition by the loan servicers who get a lot of work and have a lot of employees as a result of the current system.
Susan Danarski, Professor of Public Policy, Education, and Economics at the University of Michigan. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
This is Stateside from Michigan Radio.
Hey, I'm Nadia Davis.
I'm Katie Bird.
And I'm Taylor Williams. We're all seniors at Belleville High School, and we're the three co-founders of the Gender Consciousness Project.
The Gender Consciousness Project is a group of women's empowerment groups in the Wayne County area. Belleville has started the first one, which is called Women Up, and we basically get together once every week, and within these conversations, we talk about injustices that we all face as women of color, first-generation college students, daughters of single mothers. We create a safe space for us to talk about these struggles and not only talk about them, but to figure out how we're going to get past them.
Yeah, we talk about a lot of different topics. One of the big ones is being colored women in America. We're expected to be uneducated, loud, ignorant, mean, or angry.
Very different. Angry.
Yeah. But we're not all like that.
Social media kind of presents us that way. They profit off of us. When you look at the reality TV shows that everybody's watching, Real Housewives of Atlanta, Love and Hip Hop, the system is projecting us onto our television screens, onto social media, in music as inferior.
Because the crazy thing is there's actually a lot of minority women who are doing amazing things,
yes.
Like in STEM, in theater, in mm-hmm. everything. They have social media, they promote, they put themselves out there, but for some reason it's not as approachable for the masses. They don't want to see a bunch of black female doctors, you know, saving lives every day. Unfortunately, that isn't as impressive as, you know, marrying a millionaire basketball player and, you know, going shopping. But
that's just the way it is. And that's also one of the things that we talk about in our group, which is systematic oppression. That theme is based on the idea that it doesn't matter how smart I am, it doesn't matter if I ask questions in school or if I do well. If I am female and I aspire to be great, there are incredibly large roadblocks.
It all kind of boils down to the power of the male over you.
Yeah.
We've been conditioned by society that the male is the superior, that someone that's white is the superior.
It makes me so angry because I consider myself an intelligent person. I'm not stupid. I'm not crazy.
Preach.
Boisterous? Yes, I am. But that's my personality. But systematic oppression develops doubts. Like, it makes you seriously think that you are lacking when you're obviously overqualified for whatever position that you're trying to get. For instance, other people have told me, oh, well, you shouldn't feel bad that you're failing that class because there's tons of people that don't even take that class. Don't worry about it, you know? It'll be fine. You don't have to be a doctor. You can be a nurse. Why do you want to be a principal? You can just be a regular teacher. Like, that coddling, that makes me extremely angry. Like, how dare you put me at a lower level than what I deserve simply because I am struggling? Everybody struggles. But the fact that you lower the bar because you feel like I'm inferior or I can't handle, like, a challenge, like, that's like stepping on my new Jordans, bro. Like, how dare you? I'm trying to mind my own business and look fly, and then here you come dropping little pellets of disappointment all over the place. Like, that's not for you.
Yeah, people's bar for us is set really low. One statement I know I hate that I've heard my entire life is, wow, you're really smart for
you're
a black
really
girl.
Really smart. Mm. Really smart.
I think we all can agree to that. You've heard
yes.
it before. Yeah. I can't stand that because I work just as hard as you, if not twice as hard as you, to make it to the same level that you do. And I can't stand that we're expected to not be at the same level as everybody else because we work just as hard. We can achieve just as great things as them.
I feel like part of that is also due to not having role models in place,
yeah,
like already. I would like to go into science, okay? How many black scientists do you see in a chemistry or biology textbook? Maybe like two. And they've like won several Nobel Peace Prizes and cured a disease, you know? I feel like if more people had the opportunity to see people of color in those elite professional environments, see a black neuroscientist, see a black brain surgeon, to me, that would pump me up so much. No one could tell me anything after that. Because if they can do it, I can most definitely do it.
But a part of systematic oppression is that, you know, we're not getting put in the history books.
Yeah.
They don't want to see us in the history books.
Unless you're slaves.
For
real. Unless we're talking about slavery. Unless we're talking about Black History Month or Martin Luther King.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's the only time they want to see us in the history books. And mm-hmm. it's so many Black role models and historic figures that I never knew about from school. I had to learn from my parents or researching myself.
Yeah.
I feel like that part has to be written in by the newer generations. Because wokeness is an idea that is just awakened.
The first step is the conversation.
First step.
But the first step should not be the last step.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
I think that's where our generation is going wrong, is we have the conversation and then 6 months later we forget about it.
Yeah.
Until something else happens.
There's no movement. In the words of the professor that got us started, Dr. Nisha Hanif, we need to stop participating in our own oppression.
Hip-hop, R&B, I grew up on all of that stuff. I've always just kind of sang along with the lyrics and not realized what I was actually saying. And I would leave our sessions and I would listen to these songs that I loved. And what? Did he just say that? Like, did he really just say that? Or did she really just say that about herself? I've grown past that to not support people who don't support me.
And I don't know about y'all, but I'm an action girl. So,
yeah.
I mean, if we're going to say sexual harassment is not the thing to do, it's not up to just saying, oh, he got me too.
he got me too. Well, if he got you too, do something about it. Make him go to jail. Make him lose his job. Cause little ripples of change that can slowly spread and then give an impact that no one wants to go against. Strength doesn't come necessarily from other people. While it is supportive, it mostly has to come from yourself. And I struggled with that so much because I told myself, okay, I'm going to participate in this and Nadia and Taylor are going to be like, woo, girl power. And I'm going to march on right behind them and say, yeah. And then when stuff gets hard, I can dip. But I realized that you have to concern yourself with what's going on in the world because the world does affect you. And you have to decide whether you want to let the world change you or if you want to change the world.
That was Katie Bird, Taylor Williams, and Nadia Davis. They are seniors at Belleville High School and co-founders of the Gender Consciousness Project, a women's empowerment group in Southeast Michigan. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Both Democrats and Republicans agree the Community Health Center program is a good thing. Some 27 million Americans, including 700,000 right here in Michigan, rely on the Community Health Centers for medical, dental, and mental health care. Yet funding for the health centers has been up in the air since September. Community Health Center administrators nationwide are holding their collective breath to see whether Congress manages to pass funding in this latest round of budget battles. One of those administrators is Dr. Felix Valbuena. He's the CEO of the Community Health and Social Services Center. It's known as CHASS, and it's in Southwest Detroit. Dr. Valbuena is just back from Washington, where he was making his case to members of Congress. Doctor, welcome to Stateside.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
First, tell us a little about CHASS. How many people do you serve in a typical year, and who do you serve?
So CHASS Center is a federally qualified health center that provides care to primarily the Southwest Detroit community. We care for a little under 12,000 unduplicated users a year from our single site center, which is located on 4th Street in the corner of Junction in Southwest Detroit.
And what services do you offer?
So we provide comprehensive health and wellness services. We take care of pediatric patients from the newborn age all the way through the geriatric population. We have a fair number of prenatal care patients that come through. We have dental services, pharmacy services, behavioral health services, basically services associated with the health and wellness of our community.
And how much of your funding comes from the federal government?
30%. We have a very high number of uninsured patients. It's roughly 55%.
So what was your message when you met with members of Congress?
So the message yesterday when we were in Washington was to urgently pass the much-needed funding that our 1,400 organizations across the country need, because there's going to be, you know, 9 million patients that are going to be without care if something isn't done very, very soon. The urgency was the most important thing that we took to them, because we're at a loss now, and we've put hiring freezes, and there's centers that are already laying people off. It's a dire situation, and we're very, very concerned and worried that people are going to lose care.
Just so I'm clear in my mind, when you use that figure of 9 million, where does that come from? Because I my understanding is there's overall some 27 million Americans that rely on
Correct. There are 27 million patients that our centers serve. The 70% that we would lose would affect roughly 9 million patients across the country.
Okay. What kind of response did you get with this message?
We fortunately have always been blessed with bipartisan support throughout the years since community health centers have been in existence. And because of other, to Congress, more pressing issues, we've kind of been put on the back burner. But they're listening to us. And there was actually a press conference that was done by Representative Stefanik from New York right in front of the Capitol. We had a large contingency there from community health centers across the country, and Representative Stefanik had senators and representatives from both sides of the aisle that were there that spoke and, you know, stressed the importance of moving this forward and talked about their willingness to do this, and that they have, you know, they're talking about it in committees and they're talking about it with their colleagues. You know, they can't promise, but they said that they were going to get this done for us.
Well, it just, it's, I think it's hard for so many of us to understand when there seems to be, everybody seems to be singing from the same page in the choir, that it's a good program, bipartisan support. Did you come away with any clearer understanding as to why funding hasn't been renewed, since everybody seems to agree it's a great idea?
I didn't. You know, they couldn't really explain the why, but kept reassuring us that this is going to pass in this, you know, in this round of the extension of the government.
So in your own operations, what has the funding uncertainty done?
Well, we have a hiring freeze right now. There, you know, we have contingency plans to cut services to patients. Roughly 2,500 patients that we serve would not get care if this funding doesn't go through. So we're still sitting on pins and needles and have this plan in place that, you know, we've already started to act on, that we'll have to continue to act on if funding isn't approved.
To be clear, as of this day, as you and I are talking, have you had to cut back on caring for patients?
You know, we have the demand, and we have long waiting times, and there are staff that we're waiting to hire, but I have not hired them because of the fact that, you know, it's uncertain if we're going to have monies to be able to pay them. So at this point, we haven't cut services, but we haven't expanded to meet the current demand, even though we have the staff to hire because of the uncertainty of the funding.
How is this hitting you, hitting your staff?
Oh, everybody, this is a day-in and day-out worry. The staff, and most of our staff members are from the community. So the community's on pins and needles, the staff's on pins and needles, and, you know, we get these reassurances, but until we actually see things are passed to the president for signature and he signs, there's tons of anxiety in the center currently.
Dr. Felix Valbuena is the CEO of CHASS, the Community Health and Social Services Center in Southwest Detroit, one of the 45 community health centers providing health care to some 700,000 people in Michigan. Thank you so much for spending time with us and talking with us, Doctor.
Thank you so much.
You can help kids read books, and you can help as they draw pictures. But an app created in West Michigan lets you do both. The app is called Wimage, words and image, see? It's being taken into classrooms where students are able to combine their imaginations with the app's technology. It's also being used in art therapy, helping wounded veterans heal through art. Here with us now from West Michigan is Michael Hyacinth. He's the creator of the Wimage app, and he's the CEO of the nonprofit group Has Heart, which helps veterans through art. Michael, welcome.
Thank you, Cindy.
And we welcome Kevin Kamerad. He's an author of children's books. He's known as an entertainer, goes out, entertains children with music and art. And along with his wife, Stephanie, he created a puppet that puts a friendly face to the Wimage app, a little robot mascot called Wimmy. Kevin Kamerad, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Cindy. It's great to be here.
Michael, briefly tell us, what does the Wimage app do?
Wimage, words to images, is a technology that empowers kids to visualize their thoughts. And our goal with the technology is to empower kids, starting at an early age, to become producers of technology and not just consumers of it. So with the app, a child can instantly say a word or spell the word out, and an image instantly appears. And from there, it just brings forth further ideation, creativity, imagination. So it's a tool that allows kids to be visual storytellers, authors, designers, illustrators, and things that will prepare them for 21st century jobs and communicators of their ideas.
How did you hit on the idea to create this app? What were you aiming at, and who were you aiming at?
The inspiration behind the technology came from a nonprofit I started called Has Heart. And it's an organization that pairs wounded veterans with designers. And so we saw the impact that creativity was having on veterans. And I said that there should be a way where perhaps individuals who have disabilities or who lack the creative experience could still visualize their thoughts. And so Wimage came to fruition, initially started as an idea to help veterans independently create, is now a tool that is being shared around the country with elementary age students through this partnership I have with Kevin, empowering kids to be producers of their own creative content.
Yeah, let's talk about the fact you invited Kevin and Stephanie Camerad in on the project to do what exactly? What were they going to bring for you?
Yeah, well, Kevin is one of the most creative individuals that I know. And we saw that the tool at its current position is a great tool for education. So we wanted to combine ed tech in with art tech. And we wanted to create a face for the technology where kids can feel comfortable and feel as if that they don't have any block or deterrences from creating. We saw how puppetry and robots can play a key role in allowing kids to be free in creativity and expressing themselves. So I said, if I needed to put a face to this app that would invite kids to be creative, there's only one person that I would perhaps want to reach out to, and Kevin Camerad is that person. And the character is Wimmy, and he's a great friend of ours, and kids love him.
So Kevin, you get this call, and this says what to you?
Well, Michael and I had known each other a little bit at that time for about a year, and when he presented the idea, I was fascinated with what he was doing and started to kind of figure out more about it and what it could become, you know, with the idea of creating this puppet and this character. And Joe Emery is actually the puppet builder who helped us to go from concept to puppet. Zoe Wilson is the artist who kind of conceived. So it was very collaborative in the concept of saying, okay, here's the technology. Let's try to create a character, you know, using that, you know, common concept, you know, of Sesame Street and characters for kids and families where kids can identify and relate. And so trying to, you know, just make it playful, both in the technology and then outside of the technology, you know, as a real life experience with puppet and people and kids.
So pulling kids in, what age kids are we aiming at here?
Elementary school and then preschool as well. We've got different programs that we do specifically designed for the different ages, kind of matching where they're at, what makes sense. With the older kids, we go further and we're developing books with them now. But at the same time, all that being said, you know, it all was rooted, you know, back with Has Heart and for adults, you know, for vets. And so it's really open to anyone who wants to be able to create a visual representation of ideas that they're thinking of.
And you're taking Wimmy into classrooms and bringing Wimage, the app, into classrooms. What are you seeing in the classrooms? How are kids responding to the app and also to Wimmy?
It's been awesome to see the response, you know, both on the concept of what they can do with the app and then how the character creates the playfulness. In fact, when we do the workshops, often we'll have the character introduce the book, the songs, it's playful, and then we explain and teach the app, we're using the app, and then kids are creating something where then we'll bookend it with bringing Wimmy back, and he'll interpret what he sees, and very intentionally, the character will be playful and whimsy and silly, and kind of almost intentionally misinterpret or go kind of off on a tangent, where then the kids are like, no, the frog wanted to jump over the pond because he was, you know, whatever the case may be. So it kind of gets them a little more courage to communicate their ideas instead of saying, okay, tell us what you created. It creates kind of this more relaxed environment to just have fun.
And so starting at an early age of going into these classrooms with preschoolers, with the little ones, I'll start with you, Michael, with this question. What are you hoping they'll take with them as they proceed through school?
Well, absolutely. Originally, I grew up in the Bronx, and I just remember growing up in the Bronx and not actually recognizing that art is something that I should have any engagement with because we did not see art as a means of a tool where I grew up. And so personally, I see art as a very, very valuable tool that allows our kids, especially kids in urban communities, to understand that their ideas and their thoughts can play a key role, not only at home, but outside of their homes. And so starting at an early age, empowering these kids to recognize that their ideas are valuable and their thoughts can become real, it just gives them an opportunity to be very confident. It helps build up their morale, their self-confidence, and allows them to be communicators so that when they start to develop, you know, those skills that they are not starting at a disadvantage. And so starting at an early age, WIMAG is that perfect tool that empowers kids to be producers at the age that they're at and not just consumers, because technology right now is just a tool where, you know, so many kids can just sit there and just consume. And so we want to see technology as a very valuable tool, but also see it as a tool where kids can create and ideate and think critically as well. And so just giving them that tool so that when they do get older and they're starting to age maturity-wise, they're in a position where they can compete with other kids' vocabulary, you know, the ability to think about them, their ideas will put them in at an advantage or equal the playing field.
It strikes me this could be terrific for English language learners. Are you seeing that in the classrooms, Kevin?
Absolutely. You know, the concept of being able to have the image and the word together, we're working to take intentional steps to even purposely pursue that benefit even more. We're also hoping to get different languages into the app down the road. There's a lot of ideas of where we want to go with this, but definitely to be able to see the word, see the image, and develop that vocabulary is definitely a huge aspect. And not only to do that, the vocabulary that you're learning, instead of it being just kind of like we're studying words and learning, it's the idea that we're being collaboratively creative. And from the kids' perspective, it's fun. They're creating something, and it's almost subconsciously absorbing those vocabulary and those words.
What are the first languages you'd like to add to the app?
Spanish would be our first go-to right away, followed by Swahili is kind of our plan. We've been in contact with the Refugee Center here in West Michigan and trying to learn what makes most sense right in our community to focus on. And then as we expand and go further, we would kind of evaluate from there.
So let's talk about expanding. I've seen videos. I've gone to the website, WIMI.TV. I've seen videos of you in the classroom. Can this come to classrooms without you with it? I guess there's only one Kevin. There's only one Michael.
Currently, it is us, you know, getting the grassroots kind of ball rolling, but we would love to pursue the idea where others could go out and do these workshops, you know, as expanding, you know, what we're doing to have a greater reach. And then ultimately, as the technology develops, where classrooms, teachers, families, I mean, right now, anybody can download the app for free. It's in Apple Store. So it's a free resource right away. And as it expands and we get more capability and more functionality in there, more tools, more resources, it'll become more and more intuitive to do it without us. And so our goal is to just keep plugging away.
And you've got a book, WIMI's Words.
Yeah, the book is written by my wife, Stephanie, and it was illustrated by, we say, WIMI and friends. The idea is that we illustrated the book using the technology of the app. It's a very simple text and pattern-based kind of structure so that it follows a lot of things with rhyming, alliteration, preposition, strong verbs. So there's a lot of built-in educational elements, but with the true connection to the technology of the app, you can re-illustrate, redesign, reinterpret, and then go beyond the book as well.
All right. So that book is available. It's out there, WIMI's Words. The app is available right now for Apple. And I are you going to be moving into Android as well?
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things is, you know, as a startup, you're always looking for ways to further expand. We're currently right now fundraising with hopes that we can get some investment so that the app will be accessible to people of different languages, different operating systems. And so Android will be next. But currently right now we're working on the ability to customize and create your own storybook all inside the current app. And then from there, we'll branch out into different operating systems.
Well, you can find out more about the WIMI app as well as the book and the programs Kevin and Michael are offering by going to the website WIMI.TV, and that's WIMEE.TV. Michael Hyacinth, Kevin Camerad, thank you so much for giving us a sense of the work you're doing in West Michigan, and we'll be watching to see as it spreads throughout the state.
Thank you, Cindy.
Thank you, Cindy.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Danny Hensel, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.